You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
I am super stoked about this because this is probably one of the highlights. And I mean, we're just coming in after the season, into the season after Pi Social,
yeah,
which is one of the highlights of my year. But I love when we get to do history series.
This is my Pi Social right here.
I love when we get to do history series with Dr. McKenzie because I learned so much. And so we're going to pick up close to where we left off before in our last history series. We're going to take a look at the foundation, the history of Lutheranism in America. We're going to do that in just a moment. Today's episode of The Coffee Hour is underwritten in part by Concordia University Irvine. You can learn more about Concordia University Irvine by visiting cui.edu. Joining us for this series, the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie. He's the Forrest E. and Francis H. Ellis Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and our frequent guest for all things Lutheran history here on The Coffee Hour. Dr. McKenzie, welcome back to The Coffee Hour.
Well, thank you, Andy and Sarah. Always glad to visit with you guys and share a little Lutheran church history. So glad to be here.
How would you describe what we're getting ready to dig into over these several episodes? What would you describe this history as if you were to describe this era?
What we want to talk about is, first of all, place of the Augsburg Confession in defining what it means to be Lutheran, how that happened in the 16th century. But from there, we want to move to North America, what would become the United States, and talk about, well, what happened to Lutheranism during the colonial period, New American Nation, and so forth. And in particular, what happened to people's commitment to the Augsburg Confession? If the Augsburg Confession was important in defining Lutheranism, did it remain important in defining Lutheranism when Lutheranism crossed the Atlantic and started to operate in North America? And the answer is, well, as we'll see, that it almost disappeared, but then revived in the 19th century, not necessarily as a result of the Missouri Synod, but at the same time the Missouri Synod was getting founded, Lutherans in America were finding, again, the Augsburg Confession. So that's what we're going to talk about.
I'm really excited for this series. Let's talk about the Augsburg Confession in Lutheranism in 16th century. What was the place of the Augsburg Confession at that point in Lutheran history?
Well, the important thing to realize about the Augsburg Confession in the 16th century is that it functions as a basic definition of what we mean by the Lutheran Church in the 16th century, but it does so in two different ways. The way that we're used to thinking about it now is as a theological statement. This is what Lutherans believe. And that's true in the 16th century. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But it also came to function as a legal document, and that is as the state, the government, went through a process of deciding if there was going to be more than one form of Christianity, whether Christians other than Roman Catholics would have legal rights within the European countries. Lutheranism got some of those legal rights, but it did so on account of its adherence to the Augsburg Confession. So the Augsburg Confession became a legal document as well as a theological document. If you were legally committed to the Augsburg Confession, then you got whatever rights the Lutherans had achieved. If you weren't committed to the Augsburg Confession, you didn't get the rights that Lutherans had achieved or did achieve in the course of the 16th century. So it's a legal document as well as a theological document, and that's part of the story that we want to talk about today.
That seems, I'm sure, to contemporary American minds, a document that's both theological and legal seems a bit confusing.
Yeah.
Foreign to us, really. All right, so let's unpack some of the history here of the Augsburg Confession and what's happening with Lutherans as they come to America.
Okay, for sure. Well, if we go back to the 1520s, which begin basically with Luther's great confession at the Diet of Worms, we realize that Luther, in his theology, was not only a person confessing the faith, but also a person who was being addressed by the powers of the state, the government, for confessing that faith. So at the Diet of Worms, Luther was not talking to church people, theologians, professors like himself. He was talking with the great political leaders of the day, including the greatest of them all, the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, Charles V. So he was in a legal proceeding, a judicial proceeding, if you will, as opposed to simply a theological kind of discussion, proceeding, or confession. So right from the beginning of the story of the Reformation, the Reformation is two things. It's a theological movement, and it is a political movement, or a theological movement with serious political ramifications. And the reason for that was that, unlike modern society, where we can easily kind of distinguish between things that are theological and things that are political, in the 16th century, it's all one package. The government is a Christian government, and prior to the Reformation, Roman Catholic government, in which government officials are committed to the promotion and the defense of the official religion, namely Roman Catholicism. And Luther challenges that theologically, but also on account of the situation, turns out to be politically as well. So that's where this story starts. And then part of what makes it complicated is that it is so different from our way of thinking about relationship between church and state. We separate them, and in the 16th century, they're not separate. They're really together. One implies the other. So we have Luther at Worms. He's condemned by the emperor, and so he is legally, from the standpoint of the empire, he's an outlaw. Fortunately for Luther, however, he lives in a part of the empire which is ruled by a duke, also known as an elector, who protects Luther, does not turn Luther over to imperial authorities for punishment for his doctrine that had been condemned as heresy. So Luther is then both a theologian and a political issue, condemned by the empire as a whole, but protected by the elector of that territory in which Luther lives, which was Saxony. Again, we're in an era that's strange to us. It's not democratic in any way, shape, or form. People get their positions basically by birth or by being chosen by a small number of people. We're talking about the territory roughly coincidental with modern Germany today, but it's not modern Germany. It's the Holy Roman Empire. It has an emperor, and it's divided into maybe a couple of hundred smaller territories. And one of the larger of those smaller territories was Saxony. That's where Luther lives, and he's protected by his ruler, who is the elector of Saxony. So that's 1521. The message of the Reformation continues to be spread by preachers and by books and publications, and Luther's very active in producing many of those same things. And gradually, other territories, rulers in other territories, embrace Luther's cause, embrace Luther's view of Christianity. So that within the Holy Roman Empire, Lutheranism, which is spreading to different territories, is a political problem that has to be dealt with politically by the emperor. And one way in which they do that is by having these assemblies. In English, we call them diets, has nothing to do with menu, but it would be representatives of all these territories who would gather in a particular place, be presided over by the emperor or by his representative. Often, in Charles's case, it was his brother Ferdinand who presided over these meetings. And one of the things that they perennially had to talk about was what to do about those territories that were rejecting Catholicism and were protecting Luther and embracing Lutheranism. So in the 1520s, we meet several times, and this is always an issue, and it doesn't come to any kind of final resolution. At one point in 1526, they decide, we can't settle this. Every territory should enforce the edict against Luther as they want. And then a few years later, they meet, and the majority under the emperor's representative says, everybody has to condemn Luther and go back to the old way of worshiping, go back to Catholicism. And so you get the Lutheran rulers, the Lutheran cities saying, well, we're not going to do this. We're going to protest. And so they protest. And then in 1530, for the first time since Worms, the emperor actually comes back. He's going to preside over the next meeting, and he calls for a meeting of representatives of the empire for Augsburg in 1530, Augsburg being one of the more important German cities at the time. And he tells them that on the agenda, we're going to have this issue of religion, and every representative should present a statement of what they were doing regarding religion. And especially if they were changing, they should explain why they were changing, what it is that they were doing, etc. So, in preparation for that meeting, the Elector of Saxony, Luther's protector still, although by this time it's a different man from what it was in 1521, had Luther and his theologians prepare a statement of what they taught, what they believed, and the changes that they had made, so that he would have that with him when he arrived in Augsburg. So that statement, a statement was produced, and then the elector and his officials, including some theologians, went to Augsburg for this meeting. Luther could not personally be there. Luther was still an outlaw. So if he goes to Augsburg, he'll be arrested. So he has to stay back in Saxony. But his good friend and colleague, Philip Melanchthon, went along. And then there were a few other theologians there, as well as some legal officials. Well, the story goes that when they got there, those who were in favor of Luther and Lutheranism and had made changes in their churches decided that instead of each of them putting in his own confession, there'd be more impact if they put in just one statement. So that task of drafting that one statement describing what they believed and what they were doing in their churches was given over basically to Philip Melanchthon. And Melanchthon, using materials that Luther had prepared, as well as the other German theologians, put together a new statement that was eventually signed off by seven German princes, including the Elector of Saxony, and the representatives of two imperial cities for presentation to the emperor of what they believed and what changes they had made and why they had made those changes. And that statement came to be known as the Augsburg Confession because it was the confession of these states and territories in obedience to the emperor's command. And the emperor let that statement be read aloud so that everybody could hear it. There were a handful of evangelical Protestant territories that did not sign onto the Augsburg Confession because already by that time, Protestantism was dividing into two camps, the Lutherans and the Reformed. And the big issue already by that time was the definition of the Lord's Supper and what it is that communicants received when they went to the Lord's Supper. We'll get into that debate maybe a little bit later, but that was the division. So it was only some of the Protestants who signed on to the Augsburg Confession. And really, it wasn't that very many of them that did, but nonetheless, they did. And they presented this to the emperor. So it's a theological statement. This is what we believe. This is what we teach. This is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. But it was also a legal document because it's not theologians who are presenting this. It's the heads of state in these territories and in these cities who are presenting it to the great head of state, the emperor, who is the head of the entire political realm. So you're getting already right from the outset, June 25th, 1530, the Augsburg Confession is already functioning as both a theological statement and a legal statement. This is what this group holds to and is established as the official religion in their territories. Mm-hmm. So That's where we are, right at the beginning of the history of the Augsburg Confession.
And we'll pick up the rest of the story for this episode right after we take a quick break. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
Concordia University Irvine, you have the freedom to explore your future and your faith. Across over 60 on-campus and online programs, you'll experience Christian education that's uniquely designed to develop the whole person, to prepare you not just for your career, but for all of your callings in life. Here you'll explore life's toughest questions, gain lifelong skills, and make relationships that last a lifetime. Concordia University Irvine. Learn more at cui.edu.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
We're talking with Dr. Cameron McKenzie, professor of historical theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, about the birth of the Augsburg Confession and how that makes its way to early America. And before we went to the break, you were just talking about how the Augsburg Confession became to be a thing. And it's interesting to think about it as this legal and theological document. That's something that is difficult to understand as Americans now, but it's so critical to how the document functioned at that point. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, and because it's both legal and theological, it becomes really like the foundation of the evangelical Lutheran Church in Germany and then other parts of the world as well. Now, at the Augsburg Confession, just like Luther in 1531 at Worms, Lutheranism is rejected. The emperor says, no, I don't agree with this. The Roman Catholics have produced a confutation of this, and that's the document that I agree with. And the result of the diet was the emperor's decision that the Lutherans had to get rid of what they were doing and come back into traditional religion. And then it was really kind of an or else situation. You do this or else, and the clear implication was he'll be coming at you with force. So at that point, the Lutherans organized a military defensive league in 1531, right after the Augsburg Confession. It was organized in a place called Schmalkald, so it's known as the Schmalkald League. And this Schmalkald League gradually absorbed other territories. As the Reformation spread, other cities and territories then wanted to join this military defensive league of the Reformation. And by 1535, 36, 37, end of the 1530s, they had made the Augsburg Confession a condition for membership. So if you wanted to join the league that was going to protect your religion from the emperor and the forces of Catholicism, you had to sign off again on the Augsburg Confession. So once again, it's kind of a legal document that's useful in defining Lutheranism. Well, in the course of that 16th century history, at various moments, as the Reformation progressed, the imperial forces finally had to come to the conclusion that they were not ever going to be able to unite the empire once again under old medieval Catholicism. A war was fought to that effect right after Luther died. It was called the Schmalkald War. Emperor Charles V moved armies into Saxony, actually prevailed during the war. And it looked like, oh boy, now we're going to have to give up Lutheranism and go back to Catholicism. It didn't work. The Reformation was too deeply rooted already by that time. After losing the war, some of the Lutheran princes reorganized. They got help from the French. A second war broke out in the early 50s. This time the emperor lost. The Lutheran side, the opposing side, won. And so finally the emperor gave it up. And in 1555, another diet at Augsburg settled on the Peace of Augsburg, in which, again, the Augsburg Confession functioned as a legal document, because the Peace of Augsburg said, in the Holy Roman Empire, every territory can decide for itself which form of Christianity it wants, Catholic or Lutheran. But the way Lutheran was defined, it was defined as adherence to the Augsburg Confession. So freedom of religion that we take as an American contemporary ideal took one step in 1555. You could be either Catholic or Lutheran, Lutheran defined by the Augsburg Confession. Now, it'd be nice if that were the end of the story, but it isn't, because in the years following, there arose a dispute among the Lutherans over which version of the Augsburg Confession they were going to adhere to. There was the original of 1530, but then there was a revision that had taken place around 1540. Philip Melanchthon, the original drafter of the Augsburg Confession, drafted a new version which took into account some of the theological discussions and battles that had taken place since 1530 and created then this new version. Nobody thought too much about it until 1561, I think it was, when one of the Lutheran princes decided not to be Lutheran anymore. He embraced the Reformed version of Christianity. And then when he was reminded, well, if you aren't Lutheran anymore, you're not protected by the Peace of Augsburg, he said, oh, well, I can still agree with the Augsburg Confession, the second version, the Variata it was called. And if you look at the language of the Variata might let a Calvinist sign it. I'm going to read this right here. Take just a second. The original version of the Augsburg Confession said that in the Lord's Supper, the body and blood of Christ are truly present and distributed to those who eat. The Variata, the second version, said, with the bread and the wine, the body and blood are truly exhibited to those who eat in the Lord's Supper. And Frederick of the Palatinate said, I can go with the second version, not the first version. So you have this fight within Lutheranism over which version is the official. This goes along with a host of other battles that are taking place over doctrine within the among the adherents of the Augsburg Confession, until finally in 1577, again with the approval and at the instigation of Lutheran rulers, the Formula of Concord is finally written. The Formula of Concord is said, this is a confession by those who adhere to the Augsburg Confession, and they affirm that it's the first version that will define Lutheranism, not the second. So we end up with, by the time we get to 1580, we have a settled state among the adherents of the Lutheran Confession enjoying legal privileges within the empire on account of the Peace of Augsburg, that it will be the first version, the unaltered Augsburg Confession, that defines true Lutheranism and entitles its adherents to the protection of the Peace of Augsburg within the Holy Roman Empire. So it has become both a legal and a theological cornerstone of what it means to be a Lutheran by the time we get to 1580.
All right, with about a minute.
Okay.
How would you summarize what was accomplished in this time from the feast, 1580? What was the key thing that we take away from today?
That to be a Lutheran, legally as well as theologically, you had to adhere to the Lutheran confessions. But by the time we get to 1580, each territory has embraced just one form of Christianity, either Catholicism or Lutheranism, so that everybody in that territory will be either a Catholic or a Lutheran. So in Lutheran territories, it'll become just a part of the state religion that if you're going to be a preacher or something, you'll sign off on the Augsburg Confession because that's what it means to be a Lutheran.
And this was the unaltered Augsburg Confession.
Unaltered. And that's why, you know, on cornerstones of some of our old churches, you'll see that it'll describe the church like St. Matthew Lutheran Church, UAC, unaltered Augsburg Confession.
Very good. All right. In episode two of this series, what are we going to, just a quick preview, what are we going to look forward to?
We're going to talk about briefly what happens to the Augsburg Confession, especially when we get to North America and in the colonial period, Lutheranism starts to be transplanted from the old world to the new world. What happens to the Augsburg Confession?
I am excited.
Same.
I can't wait. All right, stick around or come back next week for more of this story as we take a look at the battle for the Augsburg Confession as it makes its way into North America. Our guest for this series, Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie. He's the Forrest E. and Francis H. Ellis Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. McKenzie, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Nice to be with you.
You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.